the 613 commandments
into 14 books.
Into 14 books. So, but in doing that,
the Rambam already began to categorize
the commandments. Not, you know, there's different 614, so they fall into different categories. So he formulated them into various books. So the entire work of the Mishnah Torah, which is really one of the earliest codifications of the laws, is really broken down into 14 books. And in the book, the book that we're dealing with is called Sefer Hamada, the Book of Knowledge. The word das means knowledge, so mada can refer to scientific knowledge, can refer to science. Torah umada, mada in the general sense means general knowledge, but in this context it's the Book of Knowledge. Interesting why we call it the Book of Knowledge. I mean, the entire Torah is a book of knowledge and ideas, but I think that well, let me ask you that question. That's for starters. Why would the Ram? In other words, for example, what are some of the other books? So you have the Book of Adoration. You have the Book of oh, that's good. The Book of Seasons. That makes sense because the various holidays, seasonal things like Passover, Sukkot, right, the Sabbath. In other words, laws. These are laws which have to do with the seasons, the time. So that makes sense, the Book of Seasons. And then there's the Book of Holiness, right? Which the Book of Sacrifices, because that's when we had the temple. The Book of Holiness.
Oh, that's
the Book of Holiness. No, it's not. The Book of Holiness deals with the laws of what? Anybody? The Book of Holiness? What laws? No. Oh, yes, you're right. One second. I'm sorry. You said purity.
Cool?
No. The book is interesting. That itself is a study. How he, you know, what laws he subsumed into what book? Because by giving you the title, he gives you the key to the deeper significance of the laws. Now, the laws, the Book of Holiness consists of forbidden foods, and forbidden sexual relationships. All right, those are the things. Now, what does that have to do with holiness? By doing that, they're telling you what the concept of holiness is.
Separation.
Separation? What do you mean? How is that? What? Give me an idea. Right. In other words, so what does holiness mean? One second. Why? It's true. You're not going deep enough, though. In other words, you're giving us the factor. The factor is correct, is control of the instinct. It's a separation. And why is that called holiness? This is very important. Because a mainstay, right, thou shalt be holy. Now therefore we are commanded. It's very important, it's a fundamental concept of the Torah. See, the Torah speaks in different terminology. It uses a code word, right? That you are commanded to be holy. And that's a fundamental precept. All the laws of the Torah are designed to produce a state of holiness. Now, if a person does not know what holiness is, so he's in pretty bad shape. Right? I mean, he's doing the mitzvahs, the commandments, without really achieving the objective. So what is holiness? Why is that holy? If a person is in a state... So you see right off the bat that the Torah does not regard man, Adam. I use the term man for the human species. To be human. In other words, man to be truly human, unless he's in a state of control over his instinctual life. Now, why is that so? What is the idea of holy? Now, I'll give you a hint. When the Torah commands us to be holy, it gives a reason why we should be holy. For I, your God, am holy. Alright? Now, on the surface, that would only start to complicate the issue. That would be good. What we're going to be learning over here, in the laws of the foundations of the Torah, we see, I mean, that God is completely different. The whole lesson of Judaism is that God is really unknowable.
we differ from other religions, and that's a fundamental idea, that God is undefinable.
And God is unknowable.
And therefore, God is unlike any other being
in existence.
And we can't make any comparisons between our existence and God's existence.
Yet here the Torah is saying that we should follow, we should
be holy because I am God, we should be like God.
So it seems to be a paradox.
Not only that, but it also seems to be a contradiction.
So,
what do you think? I'm giving you the question.
For holiness being that will thereby be like God, when Judaism has already taught us that it's impossible for us to even know God, let alone be like God. So I'm not just... That's exactly what Rami is saying. Can we be different? If you're going to say that holiness is to be different,
so can we say that we are different just like God is different?
That would be a contradiction.
Try. But the Torah is saying you shall be.
It doesn't say try to be holy.
And also, why try to be something which is impossible to be?
It doesn't seem to make much sense that we should strive for something which is impossible, because that can only wind up in frustration.
And that's a point.
Lori?
Okay.
What Lori's saying is that's a good point. Let me continue. Let's get to work.
Let's get to work. On the basis
of what the Lori said, I think the question is even
stronger.
Because Lori said that man should strive for perfection. Okay.
We said, I agree with that.
But the perfection in man cannot be the negation of his emotions. Because since man is a creature of reason and emotion, right? So he has to be in a certain state where he's satisfying his emotion and he's satisfying his rational faculty as well.
Now, there has to be a harmony between the two parts.
I mean, a person that just negates... The Rambam makes it very clear that people are simply negate their emotions or asceticism. To simply...
For emotional gratification
would not be, the Rambam says, that's a sinner. Because he's not living in line with his nature.
God wants us to gratify our emotions, but to do so in a rationalistic way, a way that befits a rational creature.
So it's a little bit complex. But God certainly,
that's not the perfection of God.
God, because God has no instincts. God has no emotions. If we attribute emotions to God, that is idolatry.
So that only strengthens the question.
Now, when the Torah urges us to be holy,
for I, the Lord your God, am holy, it would seem to be an impossibility.
But it is correct. That's the teaching of the Talmud, that we should imitate the ways of God, which means that the actions
that God has revealed to us,
God has revealed to us that he acts in a compassionate way.
So we should strive to be compassionate.
And God has revealed to us that he acts in a just way, that he rules. God is a ruler, and he rules the world with justice.
So that's a
character trait, so to speak. And of course, in God doesn't have character traits. It just means the manifestations that God reveals to us. But we should strive to emulate them because they are the ways of perfection. And that I agree. But when it says to be holy, that is not so readily understood. And that's my question.
Jackie?
If you take a look at by the way, let's
quickly take a look. I see there's a connection between the subject that we're studying and the question that we're asking.
This is very, very important stuff. Foundations of the Torah are different than other areas. See, the Rambam says that a person, there's a different levels of, obviously there's 613 commandments, and among those commandments there's thousands and thousands of rules and regulations. So no one... There's probably a person that doesn't sin from time to time, or there's different degrees. Some people are more perfected, keep more, but it's hardly possible to imagine people are not in violation of certain mitzvahs at certain times, right? All right. So there's different mitzvahs that, as you get more perfected, you fulfill more. But then there are certain things that define your very status
as a Jew.
In other words, these are absolute. Basic principles of what we call the faith. I don't want to use the word faith, but I use it for want of a better term. Basic convictions that if a person is a Jew doesn't have it, he's lacking in his full sanctity as a Jew. His whole status as a Jew, I mean, he's still Jewish, technically speaking, but he doesn't have a share in the world to come and so forth. I mean, his very status, his very sanctity as a Jew is diminished.
If a person, as I said, there are various commandments, all the commandments are very important, but that if a person didn't keep one of them, we could say it, in a sense, are tangential.
Although, again, it's the wrong word,
but he still retains his sanctity as a Jew. In other words, you still have to treat him as a fellow Jew, you have to treat him with compassion
And you have to help him when he's in need. If he becomes poor, you have to give him charity. See, all the obligations that we have to fulfill. However, if a Jew goes beyond the pale, for example, he does not believe in God, he does not believe in Torah, then he loses his right as a Jew. And it's just quite the contrary. I mean, we're assuming now that he's doing it out of maliciousness. It's not out of ignorance, or it's not because he's overcome by a certain emotion. What it means is the deliberate rebelliousness. In such a case, he loses his right to the Jew. He loses his right to the Jew. And we're there, it's just the opposite. It is it's a mitzvah to hate that person and not to show any consideration to that person. Because he's a wicked person, he's an evil person. Which is not the same, I said. The same cannot be said of a Jew who retains the basic emunah, the basic faith, so to speak, but is in violation. He's not such a good Jew. You know, he doesn't eat kosher, let's say. He believes in God, believes in the Torah, but even if he violates the Shabbat, but he doesn't do it maliciously, he does it because he's overcome. He's overcome by his emotions. So that type of a person would not be in the same category. That's a different kind of a person. He's sinning out of ignorance. Out of weakness. He's still a Jew. If he's in trouble, we're obligated to save him just like any other Jew. We have to come to his assistance. But here, he demarcates the basic foundation of the faith. And let's go through some of them. Number one, you have the English. I'm reading from the Hebrew. Do you have that, the listing of the mitzvot? I don't know. You have the listing there? I don't have the English copy that you have right now. Let me just have a second. You have more copies. There's plenty of copies. Alright, at the beginning he says the first book being the Book of Knowledge. This is the first of his 14 books. Treats of five categories of the law in the following order. Laws appertaining to the fundamental principles of the Torah. Laws relating to ethics. Laws relating concerning the study of the Torah. Laws referring to idolatry. And the ordinance of idolaters. And laws concerning repentance. Alright, now we're dealing here, those are the five categories which are included in the Book of Knowledge. Laws concerning the basic principles of the Torah. These cover 10 precepts, 10 mitzvot, 10 commandments, 6 of which are affirmative, that means positive commandments, while 4 are negative. Okay? Now, the first one is to know that there is a God. It is a positive commandment. Now, when he says to know, he means to have a conviction. To know rationally. But to know means to say that one has to have a conviction. But the way the Rambam understood it, in other words, obviously, this is not a simple act of faith, according to the Rambam. The Rambam held that the commandment is not just to have faith that there is a God, but to know. The Rambam held that if one studies the phenomena, if one studies nature, and if one studies history, the revelation of the Torah, one will know that there is a God.
Well, and
to have that conviction, so according to the Rambam, to have that conviction in the existence of God, that itself is a positive commandment. In fact, he says that is the foundation of foundations. If you go quickly to where it says chapter 1, number 1, I'll read from your version. Well, actually, I'll just translate from the Hebrew. It won't be the exact translation. I'm not that thrilled with this translation. The foundation of foundations and the pillar of all wisdom. Or you have sciences. Oh, that's not a bit, the word sciences. The pillar of all knowledge is to know that there is a prior existence, a first existence, a first being. And he has brought into existence everything which exists. And everything which exists in heaven and earth and whatever is between cannot exist except because of the truth of his existence. Now this is a very, very very, very important point. The Rambam didn't only say that it is a commandment to know that there is a God. But he said a further idea, and that is to say that without this, there is no knowledge at all. That if a person does not have this knowledge, then he can't have any other knowledge. It's the foundation of all knowledge. Do you understand that? The foundation of all knowledge. Why? You'll say, but suppose a person is an atheist. He can still be a very wise person. He can be a great a doctor, a great scientist, a great engineer. Yet, but the Rambam said that no. The Rambam said that the foundation of all knowledge is the... That's right. It means to say what the Rambam says is that person can't have knowledge because knowledge is not just how something functions. A person that doesn't have knowledge of the Creator, then his whole view, his whole perspective of the universe is a false one. Because he can't have any truth. In other words, he can only have true knowledge if he sees that the universe is the thoughts of God. It's the work, the handiwork of God in that framework. See, as a part, right. In other words, if he doesn't see it, he doesn't see that it's part of something larger, that it stems from the Creator, then he's light, doesn't see the whole picture. If he sees the universe as a manifestation of this supreme being and his wisdom, can he have a true knowledge? In other words, for example, I'll give you an example. Let's say a person studies a window, or he studies a door. He studies every aspect of a door. He knows everything there is to know about a door, except one thing he doesn't see, that this door is part of the house. He has no idea of the house. But can you say that he really has knowledge of the door?
Yeah.
No. Because the most essential part of the door, the most essential knowledge of the door is that it's part of the house. So if he doesn't know about the house...
You wouldn't go to a doctor who was an atheist.
No, that's it. You would go to a midwife to have your child delivered, even though she doesn't understand any scientific principles. Because that is not... Well, so you would.
No, that's
you can't do that. People go to midwives now.
That doesn't mean that they're right. People go to witch doctors who...
The point of it is, let's assume you go to a midwife. The point that I'm trying to make...
Let's assume I go to a witch doctor. What are you saying?
Because you're not giving me a chance to explain the point. The point I'm trying to make is like this. That the analogy is not a correct one. Because a person can know a certain technique. Doesn't mean they have true knowledge.
Yeah.
Okay. So if a doctor doesn't necessarily have true knowledge. Like a person that, a mathematician, doesn't have true knowledge of math, doesn't understand the ideas, he knows the formulas. You see? It's like a computer. It's like a computer. If you feed all the information into a computer, it'll give you the results. Now, a doctor may know the phenomena. He may know the cause and effect, the phenomena, but he doesn't have a true understanding of the nature. You see? That's something else. Of the nature of the thing that he's studying, that's something totally different. That's something totally different. Like a weatherman. A weatherman, perhaps, has certain principles that he works with. But does he understand the nature of the phenomena and why a thing is happening the way it is? And that's an impossibility. He doesn't have that. So it's only when what the Torah considers to be knowledge, it has to be a complete understanding of the phenomena. And of course, you can't, if you eliminate something which is so essential, that is to say that this universe is part of a larger framework, in other words, that the very nature of its existence is that it's the handiwork of God, so then you're lacking a fundamental knowledge. But you just know certain aspects of the thing. It's like the person that just sees the window but can't see that it's part of the house. So what does he know about a window? The essential feature of a window is that it's part of the house. If he doesn't see that, he has to have knowledge of the window. There's different degrees. There's different degrees, but the Rambam holds that the person, that the individual, the Torah holds, that the individual, I would say it's basic, unless the person is retarded, I mean, then it's fine, it's full. Any commandment, by the way, any commandment, there's no commandment in the Torah, there's a statement the rabbi said, that the Torah was not given to the ministering angels, or it wasn't created for angels. So there's no mitzvah in the Torah whose nature is such that only the rare, only an Einstein can perform. So every mitzvah, and as the rabbis say, all of Israel have a share in the world to come. All of Israel. which means that the average Jew is capable of fulfilling the commandments of God. And in fact, we don't even believe that the more advanced person is more beloved to God, because we say that each person is judged on his own potential, according to his own level. So, therefore, the Torah was given for all the Jewish people, and the person of average intelligence who studies the phenomena without perverted emotions. And Judaism holds, basically, that atheism, denial of God, is not rooted in pure scientific approach, but it's rooted in certain emotions, rebellious emotions, which are preventing the person from seeing phenomena. If a person looked at the phenomena objectively, he would have to conclude that there is a God. And that's why the greatest thinkers in all of history believe in God. And Einstein himself. Einstein was an individual who, though, did not believe in Judaism, but that's because he did not receive he didn't really understand the philosophical side of Judaism. So he had a misconception. He judged Judaism like any other religion. But Einstein, according, as we will see, when we study the commandments of to love God, you will see that Einstein in his writings partook of this religious experience. He's on a very high level, because he says that it's impossible. When you study the mysteries of nature, and you see the tremendous depth, the order and the rationality inherent in every aspect of nature, you get a sense of this tremendous mind behind nature. It can only be the product of a mind which is infinite. We can't even fathom it. And immediately, I mean, you have a tremendous sense of awe in the presence of this supreme being. That's why he himself is a very religious person. And he wants to form a religion of science. See? A religion of nature. I don't know if I'll get you the writing. We'll get the writings, where the quotes. Now, do you remember the name? Now, all the great thinkers throughout the ages, Aristotle, Socrates, the truly great thinkers, there was no question to them that the universe is definitely a manifestation of the handiwork of God. Aside from the fact, by the way, that the contemporary science has come around to the view that there was a creation. I mean, it's the contemporary physicists. I mean, there's been debate throughout the ages. I'm not going into that, because they're looking for a physical proof. But it is the general consensus of the contemporary physicians that the world was created, that the world is not eternal, and that there was creation. Aside from that, merely on that basis, that anyone who studies the universe and can see in it the tremendous order and the fact that everything corresponds to principles, and the more we learn about it, the more we see that everything is operates in accordance with the causality and the product of mind, and our mind can relate to that. Our mind can detect the categories to a certain extent, so you see that the product of mind must come to the conclusion that the universe is just come into being at random. So, therefore, the Torah holds that this basic idea any Jew more or less can understand. Now, the simpler person, even a child can gain, even a child. It means to say, the Rambam held that one's belief in God should not just be a blind emotional thing. I mean, it should be. That's why the Torah encourages study of science, provided it's done properly, of the world of nature. So it's subject to degree, in accordance with his understanding, in accordance with even a child, when he can begin to understand there's a God. And as he grows older, his understanding matures. It should be constantly maturing. And it should be constantly, therefore the study of Torah, because the Torah is the thoughts of God. And through Torah itself is a proof of the existence of God. If studied properly, you will see that the ideas contained therein cannot be the product of man. We've seen that in many of the cases. When we've elucidated certain ideas in Bereshit and other areas, we've seen it's impossible. No person would attribute this to man, especially thousands of years ago. There were no people. There was no society that had these ideas. And in the world, as King David said, the heavens declare the glory of God, that the entire solar system and the world, the universe, is the handiwork of God. So as I said, to answer your question, Wally, this is not. You don't have to be a genius to fulfill this mitzvah, although it's a lifelong thing, in other words, to raise yourself to a higher level through knowledge. Now, as we go on, let's go through some of these commandments. Second. Second, not to permit the thought to enter the mind that there is any God but the eternal. That is to say that God is the only God, and there are no other gods beside God. But it's interesting that he uses the expression not to even to entertain the thought. That's what's interesting about that. All right, we'll come back to that. Third, to acknowledge his unity. To acknowledge his unity. Now, what does that mean, to acknowledge his unity? What does that mean? Does anybody have any idea what that means? That's a very important principle. That there's only one God, but didn't he say before? Didn't he say number two, that there's no other God beside him? So how is it, I'm sorry? Yeah, yeah. In other words, it's different. To say that there is no other God beside him is not the same as to say that God is a unity. The affirmation of God's unity is something that we perform, that mitzvah we perform every day in the Shema. We recite the Shema. Here is the Lord our God. So that the, and there we're affirming that God, that we believe in God, the existence of God, the Lord is one. Now the Lord is one means two things. There is no other God, but it also means to say that God is a unity. Different than any other unity. How is God different than any other unity, Aviva? In other words, well, we deal with units, right? Each one of us is one person, right? Even if you're married and you're a couple, you're still one person, and you're in this still a unity, right? There's a singularity. So are you a unity, in other words? Are you unified? Are you together? So then how is your unification? I assume you've got yourself together, right? So then how is that different than God? What do we mean when we say that God is a unity? To affirm the unity of God, is that any different than to affirm the... So what? I mean, each person is a unity. You're a unity. You look pretty unified yourself, so you're a unity.
Yeah, but sometimes in our own unity, we
can't
just say we need other unity to unite with us.
You see, well, there is no such thing as a true unity. Like a rock. Is a rock a unity?
No.
But when we say that it's one rock or it's a unity, it's made up of parts. The unity is only an accidental unity. See, it's a composite of various parts. It's a composite. It can be broken down to molecules. So that's not a true unity. A true unity means its very essence is one, meaning it has no parts. But God has no parts. God's will, that's exactly what you were saying, Jackie. Therefore, God has no parts because God is not physical. But not only that, no attributes. God doesn't have knowledge and courage and will and power. No. God is one. Everything which, we don't know how this works, of course. Bear in mind that whatever we say of God is very, very limited, but this we do know, that God, it's all one. Right? God's essence is singular. And from that essence, it results in actions which are, you know, full of wisdom and so forth. Okay? So no, seriously, we have to know when something is very serious, very important. Because it's a fundamental to affirm the unity of God. See, you realize how different we are than any other religion. And this whole idea of Christianity, of the Trinity.
I don't know what that is.
Well, whatever it is, though, it's three, but it's one. See, that we, any Jew that believes in that concept of God is in violation. That God has parts, that God is the Trinity, the Father, the Son, whatever it may be, that God has different attributes. It is a violation of the concept of the unity of God. So, here's the complicated one. Fourth, to love Him. To love Him. And that is very, very complex. Fifth, to revere Him. Now, what's so complex about the idea of loving God, though? The average person would think that that's very easy. But that's the, every religious person loves God. I love God. Right? Why do I say that it's... In other words, on the emotional level, it seems to be very easy. But if a person has any knowledge, then he realizes that it's almost an impossibility. There's where the impossibility. What you thought that to know God is enough. To know God, I say, is not impossible. That's quite reasonable. But to love God is astounding. And the rabbis had a tremendous problem understanding how this we could have this commandment to love God. But why? You see, the average religious person goes around praising God, love God, I love God. Now, why do I try? Why is it difficult? Why would a thinking person agree that there's a real problem over here? Why would he have a problem with this? When a person feels that he has this emotion of love for God in his own mind, these people that have the feeling they have this tremendous love of God and God loves them, that is not the mitzvah. That is simply a figment of their imagination. In other words, what do they love? They have formed a certain image in their mind, that's a fantasy, of what they would like God to be. That's the root of idolatry, because they are simply projecting their own concepts. That's why most people derive tremendous comfort. They have these beliefs, they have their own little private relationship with God. They have their own private relationship with God. They make up the rules. If I do such and such, then God will good, then God will do this. Now, everybody has his own private religion. I know this for a fact, that everybody has their own private religion. Even non-Orthodox, or non-religious, or atheists, whatever it is. Even atheists. They're an atheist until they go into the foxhole. In the foxhole, they have their own system. And that is because they have their own system. If I do this and this and this, then if something good happens to them, now isn't it true that if something good happens to them, immediately they start to associate. I helped that person last week, but when God paid me back. And then when something bad happens to you, again, you start associating. And you're not satisfied until you can say, now I know why it was, because I was insensitive, I insulted that person, I embarrassed them.
Bobby or something, but God, I love you, God, then, right? So they love God. So what am I saying? But as you see, what they love, there's something that they projected. These are all projections, and it stems from one's infancy, because most conceptions of God are really a psychological attempt to return to a state of childhood, and it stems from childhood, from infancy, and this is the basic drive that everybody has. Now, I take this question at length on Sunday, in the very important year, and that is to say that a primary drive of an individual is to return to a state of childhood. And that is a state where all your needs are catered to, all your whims are fulfilled without any... I think that's where everybody's fantasy is, living happily ever after, in other words. The fantasy of winning the... being swept away, you know, or by winning the lottery. It's just that fantasy is to be on this situation where you're like amazing, like everything you ever wanted is always, may all your dreams come true, that kind of thing. Now that really goes back to where does it come from? Nobody that you know or I know actually gets this. That doesn't exist. There's no such thing. Because even wealthy people don't have it. And people with Donald Trump, he doesn't have a smile, he always looks miserable, right? He's not, he has enough money to do this, but, right? But the point is, it can't be. It doesn't work that way. Or like you see people, that's why people, when they achieve this kind of a state, they become extremely miserable because they thought that this is it. And they're like Elvis Presley. I mean, they start to go on drugs and this, and like they, and they get crazy because they can't be satisfied with their, at first they're happy, they're satisfying their fantasies, but then they get very disillusioned, so they try other things, that's when they're going, and then after with that, so they start taking drugs, and that gets, you know, further and further away from the normal. And of course they get more miserable, and they wind up in depression, eventually they commit suicide. But, but the point is like this, so if that's the case, so why do people persist? Everybody knows that if this great fantasy should come true, it will not make you happy. Everybody knows it. By studying reality, you can see it. Yet everybody feels that they still have that thing. If that's happened to me, right? They still want to win the lottery. They still want to become wealthy. And they still believe that if they do, if they only get that thing out there, boom. Everybody has that fantasy. Well, what it comes from is childhood. It's not in reality. I assure you, it's not in reality. It's not a rational desire. And it's an impossibility. But what happened was, there was a period of time when we did live in that state, in early infancy. In early infancy, you live in that state where most, that's right. In other words, all of your needs were gratified, and whatever you wanted, you got, and you didn't have to exert yourself. because it was done for your and the mind registered the fact. The mind did register the fact that this was due to the fact that there was somebody out there, a parent, whatever it is, that only concern was to satisfy you. So therefore you were the center of the universe. Now as you mature, each person carries around with him this idea that he's the center of the universe. Yeah, egocentricity. Each person believes in his own mind that he's the most important person in the world. That's no question about that. Each person believes that he is the most important person in the world. I mean, and of course he won't acknowledge it. He won't say it openly, but there's certain... That's why he's deeply wounded. When bad things, all these books, when bad things happen to people, to good people, what do you mean good people? Well, if it's me, it happens to you, it happens to a good person. And that's why it's a universal tragedy. Because it shouldn't be that way. Because you really... And that's what the hurt is. The hurt is a blow to your own narcissism. Every disappointment in life is a blow because it means that feeling that you obtained in childhood of being the most important person in the world is very false. And a person can't tolerate that. And that's what he has to fight. I mean, true maturity is to really overcome that emotion. True maturity. Very few mature people. And today's society, in fact, encourages you to believe that you are special, you are unique, you are the greatest, you know what I mean? That's the whole idea. Birthday. See, birthday means that's your day. In other words, why is it? Because everybody sends you a card and this and that. What's the whole idea of a birthday? Yeah, I was born this day. So if each person believes that is the most important day in history. Since you're the most important person in the universe, and the entire universe was created just for you, so therefore your birthday is a very important day. Right? I mean, let's face it. Why is it more important than any other day? I mean, or anybody else's, right?
What do you mean?
That's where this idea, that's the false idea. That's why people create God. They project. In other words, they can't let go of this idea, so they project. They can't tolerate the idea they're living in a universe where this they don't have this protection, where they don't have this fulfillment. Because this is the essence of what they're searching for, is this fulfillment. So as reality, I mean, the more you live, the more you see, the more you recognize that it's not going to happen, so you just project it now onto the universe, and there's some great force out there in God, and then you project it into the future. It didn't happen to me yet. And then you make up all kinds of reasons why yet. Well, it's because I'm not good enough, or because I didn't try hard enough. You make up your own system. So if I do this, up to a point. It's false, though. In other words, up to a point, Ronit is saying it can lead to good things. You can try and achieve, become a better person, and you try and take care of yourself, become smarter. In other words, you become... Yeah, there is a real sense in which a person is special. That is true. That is true. The rabbis do say that each person should say that for my sake was the world created. For my sake, there is another side of depressing coin that I've been showing you. There is a good. There's an upside here. Not only a downside. There's an upside. The thing is, though, it should be in a realistic sense. It should be in a realistic sense. But what I mean to say about this, I mean, you know, many people are constantly on these self-improvement things. It's a fantasy that if I only do such and such, the reason why this hasn't happened to me yet is because I haven't achieved such and such, so then they're always disappointed. Because reality is not going to change, no matter what you do. The only thing you can do is to try and conform to reality. The only happiness you can achieve is to try and learn what reality is all about, and what the real happiness for man is in this world, and try and get that. But most people don't have a concept of what their real happiness is, and they're in pursuit of something which doesn't exist, and that's the source of all misery. And there's a law that can't be changed, because you're fighting reality. God will not change reality for your whim. So you cannot, I mean, just because it's your fantasy, just because you wanted it so much, and therefore because you blame God. I mean, you love God when, it's not really a love of God anyway, you love God when you got what you wanted. That's not really a love of God. And you're going to hate God when you didn't get what you wanted. But the whole thing is absurd, because who is to say that this is the way it should be? I mean, you made up the system. That's not God. You have to say what God's system is. So that's why I say, but we'll return to Ronit's idea. That's enough. Ronit's idea that there is a sense in which each person is supposed to say, for my sake, was the world created. So,
I mean, it's not the responsibility then for people to...
I'll tell you what it means. I'll tell you, well, you see, the problem... The problem with this idea I want you to know is that you do achieve... You see, I know a lot of people that operate with this idea. That everybody wants to be... There's nothing... You've got to be very careful. You shouldn't totally discourage them, because a kid kid, when he's striving, when he's struggling, I mean, he has to really believe that that he's doing it through God, and God is happy, and he wants, if he's going in the right way. If he's going in the right way, and he has this idea, he's too young to understand. The Rambam says that. You work with these ideas. You see, he's too young to, you tell him that, you can't tell him that you should study the Torah and gain knowledge, because that inherently is its own reward, that is really truly the best way. He really, he needs something more than that. He wants to feel that that he's getting the approval of God, that he's in a special relationship with God. Well, in a sense, it is true. He is in a special relationship with God, but not the way he imagined it. So you're right, Roman. It's a good point. And I agree with that. You don't discourage it. It can lead to good results. The only problem is, it can take you so far, and there does come a point at which it becomes counterproductive. Because, you see, the payoff, you're delaying the payoff. In other words, if it is, that's what the rabbis have called serving God, shalom lishmah, not for its own sake. They use the analogy of love. In other words, you don't love, it's not a love which is for its own sake. It's a love which is for selfish motivation. It's a selfish motivation. It's not true love. Now, the downside is that because you're postponing, you're expecting something in return. And when you don't get it, you keep postponing it. And you don't get it, you keep it, God didn't pay me back yet. You keep building up in your own, this exists in human relationships too. You know, people are always doing favors for other people, and they assume, they overvalue what they do. Right? And they assume that the other one knows, and they're expecting to get paid back. And what happens is it can lead to a tremendous disappointment. So it can lead to a disappointment in your relationship with God. It is good, though, and it should be utilized, to develop the person to that level where he is then capable of letting go of that thing. And he's so totally involved now. You see, the way it's been designed, it's sort of like a booster rocket. You're right, it's a booster rocket. You can't get into the out of the atmosphere and into the stratosphere without the booster. But once you're in the stratosphere, the forces of the stratosphere themselves propel you. And that's precisely the way the Torah formulated it. It recognized that man by nature is such that he cannot get into the world of ideas. And the true love of God, without any expectation of a physical reward in this world, he can't get into there directly. He can only get there through the avenue of these powerful emotional forces. But it utilizes them. But once he's in that world, then the stratosphere takes over. He's so caught up. In other words, it's like you try and convince a person to go to something that he doesn't like, and you know he's going to like. I'll just use anything that comes to mind. Let's say like classical music. Let's assume, I'm just making these things up. Let's assume though that a person that develops a taste for it will love it, but he doesn't even like rock. It's not. He couldn't. So you have to offer him a reward to get him to go. And once he's in there and he has enough of it, then you don't have to offer him. Then he becomes fascinated with it. All right, inherently. But the point is, where are you going to start? If you don't start with those rewards, in other words, you'll treat him to five rock concerts. If he goes to one, then he won't go. You got to work within his framework. That's okay. The idea that a person should say that my thing was the world created means to say like this: that for the true fulfillment of man, in other words, when God created the universe, he only created one. There was only one human being. That's where we derive this idea. The question is, why only Adam? And all the world came from Adam. First, the woman was created from Adam, and then the rest of the world from Adam and Eve. Why didn't God create many humans? Why did God create only one human? And that was his plan, that the rest of mankind should come from one. And one of the answers that the rabbis give is so that each person could say, for my sake was the world created. Because you see, that God set into motion an entire universe, and it was worth it, so to speak, from God's perspective. How many? For what? For a purpose. God only creates for a purpose. Right? And each creature in God's system has a purpose. And since God is perfect, everything that he creates must fulfill its purpose. Otherwise, there's a defect in God as a creator. So man, too, was created for a purpose. Now, the question would be, for how many would it be worth it for there to be a universe? So that for how many people fulfilling their... For one alone. For one person fulfilling their true purpose. You see? And that doesn't mean what each person considers his own sense of fulfillment. Fulfilling their nature and their purpose insofar as God has designated them. That fulfillment that God has designed for you and that you are designed for. And that is the only way in which you can be happy, by being in line with that purpose. That is for you alone. Then you could say that's what the world for you was. The world, the whole world was created just for that, just for you. Okay, and you have a direct relationship with God. You are fulfilling God's plan, and for that, for you alone, God would have created the entire world just for you. In that sense, but not in the childish, infantile sense where we think that everything, that all of reality should be geared just to satisfy my whims. That's completely erroneous. That's completely not true. And here is where we answer the question. I'm going to answer the question. Yes, are you? No. This way, I had no idea it would come to this, but as a result of what I just said, we can answer the question that we started out with. Well, yet now. Now you all can. Now I've given you that's my method, is to lead you to the answer, and you should be able to see it now. The question was... The question was, now. The question that we just had was, and this is the question that the rabbis asked, how is it possible to love God? The Torah cannot command that which is impossible. Every commandment, as Warrior pointed out before, must be capable of fulfillment, right? Because the Torah was not given to the ministering angel. Now, one of the commandments is to love God. Now, and I think Malki made this point before, it seems, or wasn't that, was Warrior that made the point, it seems that a condition of love is that one knows the object of one's love. I mean, well, you can't have love without knowledge of what... In other words, like this, some have said, like when I raised the question with the guy, I said, well, you know, God's not physical, so you can't love God because God's not physical. I disputed that. I said that that's not a... You can love something which is not physical because you can love an ideal. Right? Or I love my country. Now the country is an ideal. It's not like a... Doesn't mean I don't know everybody in the country. When you say you love the country, or you're fighting for freedom. I'm fighting for freedom. Well, freedom is not a physical thing. It's an ideal.
But you know someone you've never even met or even seen, but because of their attitude.
But you know them, though.
Right.
You can't. You cannot love. Now, I would therefore venture to say...
You love God who created your system in the morning.
One second. But the emotion of love. We're talking about the emotion of love. Insofar as we're human, cannot... Let me explain the point. I'm positing the idea, and you tell me whether you agree with me. Because everybody has experienced love, different kinds of love, you know, love of a child, love of a friend, romantic love. But in every case, it always comes into being because you have a relationship with the loved object. You know the person, some of them, right? All right, so you may not even met, you can fall in love with the person before you've met them, let's say. Because you spoke to them. You spoke to them. You have something, you know something, or you think you know, at least. You think you know. You may be wrong. And probably you are. But at least in your own mind, you form some idea of the person, right? So, but to posit, Judaism is positing that we have absolutely no knowledge of God. We are not allowed to make any physical representation of God. And we can't say anything positive about God. We can't say anything positive about God. The only knowledge we have about God is negative knowledge. And negative means to say we know what God is not. Then how can we love God? How can we love that which is unknowable? Now, that's... Well, the Rambam will explain. Okay, the Rambam will explain. But I want to answer the question. Because we started off with the idea that the Torah commands us to be like God. To be holy, because I, the Lord your God, am holy. Alright? Now let's try and answer that question. Let's try and answer that question. Yes?
Well, I'll take a note of
the concept. Well, how to achieve it is another thing. Now,
okay.
I'm not answering that. Not to achieve holiness.
Well,
it's something else. Well, what it is. What is it to be holy?
Through
knowledge, he was able to... Okay, very good. So let's just review all the things we said and see how let's put it together. We said that subsumed in the heading of holiness is a law against forbidden food and a law against forbidden sexual activity, which basically means to say the regulation of man's appetitive, being simplified, because those would be of the appetitive. Control, rational control, though. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's right, it's under the control of his rationality. And as Renee says, that you mentioned the factor of differentiation. In other words, to differentiate us from the animals, because the animals purely are creatures of instinct. So while man does have instinct, right, but he differentiates himself because he doesn't, his actions are not determined by the instinctual. All right? Now, in this way, man becomes different, and man becomes like God. How so? Because the point of all this is that the happiness of any creature, the happiness of any creature means to be in one with one's own nature. Do you understand that? A creature cannot be, in other words, unhappiness means that you're not in line with your own nature, with your own true nature. So in order to be happy, any creature that has a nature, let's say it's the nature of a bird to fly, if you prevent it from flying, you can't be living it, right? Okay. Now, you see, with every other creature, with the animals, however, they have no choice because their purpose has been programmed into their instinct. And the mistake that people make is that they feel that they're only free to just follow their natural inclinations, they'd be happy. It's false. Because man's purpose has not been programmed into his instinct. If he merely follows his instinct, he's going to wind up confused, and of course, all of his instincts are basically in conflict, I mean, with one another. If you just follow your instincts, then you're not going to be happy. Because that's not your true essence. Fulfillment can only be in line with your nature. And then man's nature is not just to be an animal. There's the talent of him, the image of God, which means he has another faculty, the rational faculty. What we refer to as the spiritual side, whatever you want to say. So therefore, insofar as he is tied down to his instincts, he's not holy, he's not free. He's not free, he's not in line with his nature. Now, to be like God means that there is one being that we can conceive of who is purely in line with his own nature, who is perfect. Because God is perfectly in line with God's own nature. So God is the most perfect being. And God does not have instinct, you see, as we do. Right? God is absolutely free. That's absolute freedom. Because God has nothing which can hold him back, which can prevent him from fulfilling his nature. That's why God is the most perfect being. Man, however, does have forces that can hold him back from fulfilling his nature because he has instinct, you see? And he has inclinations, one second, which are in conflict with his true nature. So the command to be holy is to be like God, to be free. Now, our freedom is a relative freedom. You see what I'm saying? It's not absolute because we do have instinct. We have instinct. That's true. So it's relative. But insofar as we live in line with that part of us which is called an image of God, you see, with our rational faculty, and we function in accordance with reason, and we're not the slaves of our instincts, so we attain our freedom, and that is our purpose, and that's our perfection. To that extent, we are imitating God. In other words, we are becoming free. We are becoming creatures who are in line with their own basic nature. That's the idea that we can be like. You understand the concept? That's the idea to be holy. To be holy means to reach your true design, to reach your true purpose, to live a life which is really in line with your own nature. Now, to do so, one has to free himself from forces which inhibit him from being in line with his own nature. And that can only be through the concept of holiness. That is to say, to gain a mastery over your own nature so that you are in command. The you meaning the rational side is in command of your instinctual life, and therefore you decide. In every case, where reason determines that you should have fulfillment, you should gratify an instinct, and you gratify. And how do you do so? In an intelligent way. So that everything redounds to the, you see, in doing so, that's strengthening the personality and allowing you to fulfill your true nature. Of course, what is your true nature? What is your true nature? To be one who was created in the image of God. And your happiness is to be involved in a life in which you're in pursuit of the love of God. Which I haven't explained. That's the next thing, you see. That's the next thing. Of course, you have to have an activity which makes you happy. But it's a far cry. It's a far cry from what people imagine it to be. And I think I emphasize this because our society is very, very corrupt. And it encourages us to go in exactly the opposite direction. You see? That's why today, I mean, there's no, whatever, if a person, any whim that a person wants to satisfy, any form of, any lifestyle, any form of sexuality, if that's it, the society says, that's what you like, that's the good. And see, there's no objective reality. And they encourage you to trust, to just nurture and reinforce all of your own infantile wounds. And the Torah says that that type of a life cannot lead to any kind of happiness. There is a happiness for man. It has to be, because if man could not be happy, then there would be a defect in God as a creator. But the problem is that people do not study what the real happiness is. You see? It's just like you couldn't be a good parent. Or you couldn't be a good breeder of animals or whatever it is. If you didn't know their nature and what their purpose is, you could not bring them to a proper state. And so too with children. Well, the same is true of yourself. If you don't know what your nature is and what your purpose is, then it's impossible, almost impossible. How could you possibly be happy if happiness means to be in line with your nature? So therefore Judaism holds that really without knowledge, it's almost impossible for a person to be happy without knowledge. Knowledge of himself, self-knowledge. And this, of course, is the idea of the Greeks, by the way. This is the philosophy of the Greeks, know thyself. That was Plato, who happened to be an individual who grasped certain truths that the Torah agrees with. Okay, I'll stop there. A questions?